And some people are very excited about change, but change is also very threatening. And somehow we've got to manage this change. So our next speaker is Marion Dove. She's the Director of Faculty Development for the new curriculum, and she's going to be talking about leading change.
Hello, everyone. So when I was asked about a month ago by Rob to give a talk about leading change, I thought to myself, what on earth does that mean? And then, since I'm in academic medicine, I very quickly realized this is jargon. This is talking about the process of change and how difficult it can be for people. So this is what I'm going to be talking to you about this afternoon. What this means is that we're having a new curriculum in September of 2013. And this change is going to be quite profound, as you've heard from Colin and from Rob. And change is not always easy, as Rob just mentioned. It can be a source of stress for people. There are often doubts. And there's often some resistance to change. So what I'd like to talk to you about in the next 20 minutes or so is about the process of change, and about resistance, and about creating buy-in. Since I work in academic medicine, my first thought when I was asked to talk about leading change was to do a literature review. So the first thing we're going to do is look a little bit at the literature about curricular change in other medical schools, and see what has worked, what has not worked. This will then lead us into increasing an awareness of our own personal resistance to change and help us to bring some constructive comments to the process of change here at McGill. We're going to look then at John P. Cotter's 8 Steps to Change, which is taken from the business world. And my final point will be about taking all of these messages back to your respective departments so that we do continue in the helpful process of change. I just want to point out that I have no conflict of interest to declare. The only thing I talk about other than change is breastfeeding, and there's no money to be made in breastfeeding promotion. So some of you may be wondering who on earth I am, and I might be a new face to many of you, so I thought I would just present myself initially. I do work as a family physician at the CLSC Côte des Neiges and have been director of undergraduate education there for many years, or was for many years. So I have seen many medical students come through mainly in the clerkship setting. Since July of 2009, I have been director of faculty development in the Department of Family Medicine. And since September, since last month, the director of faculty development for the new curriculum implementation. So just to tell you a little bit more about myself, I'm going to out myself. I did not go to McGill Medical School. I went to McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, which is near where I grew up in Toronto. I moved to Montreal in 1994 for my residency in family medicine at this blockbuster video building, which is also known as the CLSC Côte des Neiges. I returned briefly to Toronto for a scholarship in women's health, and then I was able to realize one of my dreams to work in an isolated community, and I worked in the remote village of Blanc-Sablon for almost 2.5 years, from 2003 to 2005. And I don't know if any of you have seen the film La Grande Séduction, but I was actually the doctor for that village for over 1.5 years. This is the village of Harrington Harbour, and it's served by the hospital in Blanc-Sablon, and I was flown in there by helicopter for 1 week per month while I was the doctor. But normally, I'm not in such exciting places. I'm in Montreal, and so I'm either at the CLSC Côte des Neiges or doing deliveries at the Jewish General Hospital, which is right across the street, or in this lovely part of the Montreal Children's Hospital in the adolescent clinic, or at La Maison Bleue, which is a project of the CLSC Côte des Neiges. So with that brief introduction of myself, we're now going to move back to the learning objectives. So the first thing we wanted to do was to look at literature about change in other medical schools' curricula. And luckily for me, there's a great resource that I had, namely Robin Featherstone, and I don't see her here today, but she very quickly found for me some articles about leading change in medical curriculum, and it seems that there's an article that told me everything I need to know, namely Curricular Change in Medical Schools, How to Succeed. So that's what I'm going to talk to you a lot about today. And there are a couple of other articles I will mention which talk about the curricular change at Johns Hopkins University and at the University of Florida and some specific things that were useful and not useful to them in their curricular change. So the first article, How to Succeed. This is an article that did an extensive search of medical databases for medical education and change. They had over 1,000 hits in 4 different databases and ended up reviewing intensively 57 articles, finding that there are 35 features of successful curricular change that are consistently reported from all the literature. I am not going to tell you all 35 changes right now. They classified into 13 categories these changes, and they were in the broad realms of context, curriculum, and process. And guess what? Curriculum was the least important. It's all about context and process. So the 6 most essential categories were all within context and process, and these categories were mentioned in 25 to 61% of the total sources, depending on which of the 6 categories they are. And so these 6 categories are politics, cooperative climate, participation by organization members, human resource development, evaluation, and leadership. So we're going to go over each one just briefly so you'll know what is important for curricular change. So in terms of politics, I'm going to start with a quote by a U.S. president. Now this is from a time when U.S. presidents still said things that were worth quoting. So Woodrow Wilson said, "It is easier to move a graveyard than to change a curriculum." One thing that is very important is the presence of strong, influential advocates who are promoting change. So we're talking about the level of the deans, associate deans, and so on, and buy-in of powerful individuals and departments, so chairs of departments, people who are in positions of power within the university. The cooperative climate. What was very important in realizing curricular change was a positive and respectful work climate, high professional expectations, collaborative problem solving, rewards for risk taking, and skillful conflict resolution. Thirdly, it was very important that the organization's members participated in the change. This was shown to strengthen collective ownership of the new curriculum, deepen commitment to the new curriculum, and help build resolve to move forward. Human resource development was also very important, and that, I guess, could be interpreted as what I'm supposed to do, the faculty development part of the new curriculum. So training support, high quality and ongoing training support, peer coaching, team problem solving, leadership training, and orientation for new faculty. And certainly, I will be working with Miriam Boyat at the Faculty Development Office to work on these kinds of things for faculty in the new curriculum. The reward structure is something that we might need to talk about on a broader basis. Incentives to reward participation in the new curriculum. And promoting curricular change as an experiment to increase buy-in. It seems that in other institutions, what has worked is enticing faculty to participate by letting them think, telling them that it's a new experiment and something that's kind of exciting to participate in. Evaluation is very important for curricular change. It can legitimize the innovation process, and it's important to hold the innovation to the same high standard as the rest of the medical school. It's important also to have ongoing formative evaluation or feedback. This can help identify difficulties that arise in the new curriculum, to help solve problems, It fosters open communication, promotes a cooperative climate, and can renew commitment to and ownership of the change. And finally, leadership. So we mentioned already the deans, the associate deans, and so on. What is very helpful for curricular change is to have this be a stable group of people who are flexible, who are able to mobilize others, and who exhibit an assertive participative style, which involves willingness to compromise, being respectful towards others, and not becoming defensive when they are challenged. And I think we're lucky that we do have that style of leadership for our new curriculum. It's very important to be effective in communicating and promoting shared vision and shared culture and values, and in providing encouragement and positive reinforcement. So those were the six most essential categories for successful curriculum change in that article that was essentially a meta-analysis of the literature. In the literature review, though, I also found a couple of articles with interesting points from two specific universities, so I'd like to draw your attention to these articles. The first one is from Johns Hopkins University, and the second one will be from the University of Florida College of Medicine. So at Johns Hopkins, there is a professor, Barton Childs, who in 1999 wrote a book called Genetic Medicine, A Logic of Disease. And this book really inspired one of the deans at Johns Hopkins. The point of the book was to say that medical curricula are not suited to the nature and pace of scientific work and societal changes that we're having now in the 20th and 21st centuries. And the vice dean launched a strategic planning exercise about how will medicine be practiced in 10 years as a result of reading his colleague's book. And this all took place in an institution with a successful history of educational innovation. And so the themes, the trends that were identified at Johns Hopkins in the early 2000s in medicine were the elucidation of the human genome, the aging population, changing economics of healthcare, increasing interest in public health and global medicine, and the rapid development of diagnostic and therapeutic technologies. And I think we saw that in the initial slides that Rob showed about all the changes that have happened in society since 1994. They developed a new curriculum with the following features. They used more non-lecture teaching. So team-based learning, learning studio presentations, group computer work, electronic whiteboards, and simulations. They were lucky enough to have funding for a new building with space for community events, group study, and individual study. They also had faculty development with workshops, retreats, and trial classes. And they improved their assessment of and rewards for teaching. So I guess your question could be, well, why did they do this new curriculum with non-lecture teaching? What's the point? So the reason is, why do we do small group learning? We learn about 10% of what we read, 20% of what we hear, 30% of what we see, 50% of what we both see and hear, but 70% of what we have discussed with others, 80% of what we experience personally, and 95% of what we teach someone else. And this is according to a psychiatrist from Case Western Reserve University, which has been a pioneer in developing problem-based learning in medical education. So the idea with small group learning would be the 70% of discussing with others and the 95% of teaching to others within the small group. Going back to Woodrow Wilson's comment about moving a graveyard, the University of Florida had an exercise in continuous curriculum renewal, which is something that Rob was alluding to. Between 1991 and 1996, they changed their curriculum in a variety of ways. And I'm just going to highlight some of these things from this slide. So the first point about the introduction of early clinical experience in primary care settings. We're certainly going to be having that with our longitudinal family medicine experience. The enhancement of active learning experiences in small group settings. The production and use of computer-based interactive learning materials. We have new rooms being developed at McIntyre for this type of teaching and learning. Increased clinical teaching and ambulatory care training in an interdisciplinary primary care clerkship. So the clerkship changes will be discussed at another time. But there are certainly many of the changes that they did at the University of Florida that are reflected in what we're proposing here at McGill. some factors that facilitated the introduction of changes. They're very similar to what we saw in the review article. The interest and support by the dean for the changes, a clearly defined delegation of authority to an associate dean who was implementing the new curriculum. They introduced a new budgeting process which allocated educational funds based on teaching effort and teaching quality. They empowered their curriculum committee, and they identified principles. They had a very clear guideline that should be used for educational planning and implementation. So those are some of the things that have happened at Johns Hopkins and at the University of Florida, and that's a little bit of an overview of what curricular change is all about and what can make it successful. So I'd like to move now into, that's about the moving the graveyard. So these efforts are considered the beginning of the continuous renewal needed to respond to information networking, scientific and technological innovations, and the fundamental changes in healthcare delivery. So seeing those three articles, what I'd like to do now is move into thinking about how they relate to our situation here at McGill. So knowing what has promoted curricular change in other places, I'd like us to now divide into little groups of two at your tables and talk to your neighbor for the next few minutes about resistance to change and short-term wins. So the idea is to talk to your neighbor about what will be a challenge for your department in the new curriculum. Why might you not want to change? And at the same time, I'd like you to talk about short-term wins. What will your department gain? What will you gain from the new curriculum? So if we can just take a few minutes to talk about that, and then we'll come back with some answers for the large group.
Thank you.
So if people can wrap up their discussions, we'll come back to the large group. So I'd be interested to hear a few comments. At my kids' school, when they present a project, they're allowed 3 comments and 3 questions. So maybe we'll have like 3 items of resistance to change and 3 short-term wins. I don't know if anybody has a thought about what came out of your discussions about resistance to change. Yes. It would be better if you could go to the microphone, yes.
Or the microphone, I should say. We talked, Yvonne and I, about the idea that program evaluation could be a very influential, potent factor in minimizing or mitigating resistance to change. So if something is built in from the very beginning of an innovation or a change that is going to be evaluated ongoing, it's going to be very helpful. And physicians love data. Physicians love numbers, and increasingly words as well, but they love data. They like to be persuaded. So I think change will be fostered if we evaluate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for that comment. Any other thoughts about resistance or short-term wins?
I was thinking in terms of pediatrics is the idea that all of this means that we have to be willing to change our model of care and understand child health as something that is shared with many different people, because that's basically what's there, you know, the continuum of primary care to tertiary care. And then in terms of short-term wins, Lenny and I were talking about the Osler Fellowship. So we do perceive the disconnect sometimes between what we do as Osler Fellows now and the curriculum. So if we were Osler Fellows in a new curriculum and didn't see that or saw more connection, I think that would be a short-term win.
Great, thank you.
Helen and I discussed the issue of fear of change. Whenever there's change, everybody feels he's going to lose something. But in essence, often the change will lead to unexpected gains. So I think change is here.
Mm-hmm. Just as an example, in one of the articles I was reading, some of the basic scientists had been very concerned about losing their teaching time. But when they actually taught students in small group settings, they were able to excite the students about their research and talk to them informally and get them actually very interested in cutting edge stuff. And so this was a gain that they had not anticipated. And actually, exactly as you're saying, there are some unanticipated gains.
One of the things we discuss is we need to have buy-in for the change by the entire medical faculty. And to be able to do that, this meeting, for example, should have been very heavily advertised ahead of time. I think people who are here are learning a lot and are appreciating why we're going through this transition, why the new curriculum is coming in. We're a very small percentage of the faculty. And I would urge that there be more transparency to the entire faculty, to an open meeting, to open discussion before we implement this. You'll get much more buy-in. People, I think some of the ideas are great, but they've got to be discussed openly.
I think that's a very important comment, and that's going to come out actually in my last part of my talk now. Were there any other thoughts that people wanted to share about resistance to change or short-term wins? Okay, so we'll just go on to the final part, which is about Cotter's stages of change. So who is this guy, Cotter? John Cotter wrote a book in 1995 about leading change, and he was a professor at the Harvard Business School, I guess the McGill of the South, as we like to say. So he has 8 stages of change in his book, and the first one is to create urgency. So we're all doctors, we're good at creating urgency. But more concretely for the curriculum, these are some of the things that created the urgency for us to have curriculum renewal. The last accreditation report, which I think Colin touched upon, that we were short on some of the standards. The Thinking Dangerously Strategic Initiative, the recommendations for the Canadian Medical Education from the AFMC, and the FMEC report. These were some of the things that created a sense of urgency for us to change our curriculum. The second step of change in Cotter's 8 stages of change are to form a powerful coalition. And we do have a powerful coalition. These are some of the people who have been very active in promoting curricular change. And I'm sorry if I left some of you out. Anybody whose picture is not here, it's because you're not on Google. So put your picture on Google and you'll be in the next version. The third step is to create a vision for change. Now, I don't think Colin knew that he could have just clicked and downloaded it from the internet. You see, you can go vision for change. There it is right there. And instead, they did hours and hours of planning to make a new curriculum. So these are some of the groups that have been active. The Curriculum Implementation Executive Committee, which has had monthly meetings at least since early 2011, and the new Curriculum Advisory Committee, which has bi-monthly meetings and presentations also for almost 2 years now. The fourth step, which I think is what our last comment was about in the resistance to change, was communicating the vision. This is ultimately important. Cotter talks about the problem of under-communicating. You have a single meeting, you have a single communication, you have a speech to a group of employees, you have newsletters, and nobody knows what's happening. So what he suggests is that you really have to incorporate messages into your hour-by-hour activities about the new curriculum. So in routine discussion, talk about how the new curriculum fits into the bigger picture. In performance appraisal, talk about how the employee can help with the new curriculum. In a division performance review, talk about how the division, how they're contributing to the new curriculum. And in general question and answer sessions, any type of meeting, tie your answers in to the new curriculum. Use every possible channel of communication. Communicate frequently and powerfully. Embed the message within everything you do. And I guess I'm calling upon everybody in this room to do what they call walk the talk. That is, talk about it constantly, and what we do is more important than what we say. So just thinking always about the new curriculum and ensuring that everything we do is aligned with the new curriculum. Some of the other suggestions, which are a bit more mundane, is to have lively articles in newsletters promoting the new curriculum, exciting discussions in CMDP meetings or something. Courses focusing on the new curriculum, I guess that could be faculty development. Faculty development type of activities or workshops. The leaders are supposed to become living symbols of the new curriculum. And you must have planned redundancy, where everybody has heard about the new curriculum so often that it's really redundant. Removing obstacles is the next step. How many of you drive in Montreal? Okay, so I guess you won't recognize that these are obstacles because this is just normal for here. But obstacles, there are sometimes people who are afraid of change, as we just mentioned. I think we all know green eggs and ham, or how fear of the unknown hinders the development of informed opinions. So we need to reward people who are making change happen. And we need to identify people who are resistant to change and help them see what is needed to succeed. And some suggestions that have come up in informal discussions I've had are that we should involve people who are resistant into the planning of the new curriculum or get them involved as co-teachers so they really can get some kind of buy-in and understand what the change is about. Creating short-term wins. We just talked about that a little bit. We'd like to give everybody a raise or give everybody a medal. I'm not sure that will actually happen. But there are some things to keep in mind. There are going to be renovations in McIntyre, and there will be some nice new teaching spaces. Teaching in the new curriculum is an opportunity to keep current in medical education. It's a chance to influence the course of medical education. You'll meet new colleagues, It's exciting to be a pioneer in this initiative. Building on the change, what we saw in the article from the University of Florida was that there's something called continuous curriculum renewal, and certainly we will be needing to evaluate the new curriculum as we're going on and build changes in as they become necessary. So this will be a cycle of change that looks something like this, with student and teacher feedback feeding into a global evaluation, communication going back to block leaders or theme leaders, and adaptation of the curriculum as necessary. Some of the things that Colin mentioned to me informally that have already been integrated as changes are that the paper and the real world calendars are now harmonized, that there is an hour by hour almost calendar set up for how the first year at least of the new curriculum will look. The dental students are integrated well. They're going to be in two particular quintiles so that they will not be going to family medicine but will be doing other activities on Wednesdays and Fridays. And the anatomy teaching is now going to be over 18 months, and so there will be first and second year students trying to use the anatomy lab. But the calendars actually mesh nicely, and it's created some spaces, so that's another unintended side effect or unexpected win. So there will be some new space for the anatomy lab. So these are just examples of building on the change. And the final thing is to anchor the changes in your culture so that it becomes the norm. So some of the changes that we will be seeing, the longitudinal family medicine experience, it has huge potential. The students are going to be exposed to clinical medicine right from the start. Family physicians are going to be much more responsible for the students' learning and will be much more part of the Faculty of Medicine at McIntyre. So these are some of the big changes that will be coming. So just to wrap up, those are the 8 stages of change according to Cotter, and what I'm going to ask you to do now is to take these messages back to your respective departments, sort of in keeping with the communicate, communicate, communicate message. There's 3 very basic things. Just talk to your friends. I think probably everybody in this room has friends. Just talk to them. Hey, have you heard about the new curriculum? Second thing you can do is encourage your friends to be pioneers. So maybe you won't be Emily Stowe, Canada's first woman doctor. Maybe you won't be Dave Sackett, who was a guru of evidence-based medicine from McMaster, but a pioneer in a smaller way. And the third thing is to get feedback from your colleagues, from your friends, as the implementation phase is underway. Seek feedback, see what we can do to make the curriculum, the new curriculum, even better. And to quote another U.S. politician, I don't know why I keep quoting U.S. politicians, but John Gardner, who was U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare until he quit because he was against the Vietnam War, said, "I am entirely certain that 20 years from now, we will look back at education as it is practiced in most schools today and wonder how we could have tolerated anything so primitive." So I think this is just an example of how curriculum renewal really is an ongoing process. And that is all I have to tell you today. Thank you. I don't know if we have time, Rob, for questions or comments or...
Your excellent presentation contained an abundance of data from the USA. I'm surprised that you didn't mention the University of Calgary, which initiated this process and which we are imitating. There's some very good articles by Mo Watanabe and Henry Mandan in the literature explaining what they went through. I'm sure you've read them, and if you haven't, you should.
Thank you. I didn't have a ton of time, and I didn't get the Calgary article till too late to include it in the presentation. But thank you. That's a very good suggestion.
Despite Dr. Seuss, I'm still scared of green eggs and ham, even if it's on the surface or inside. I don't know. But actually, my question is the numbers that you showed, the percentiles for learning, for retention of knowledge, they were like 50, 60, 70, whether you hear it, whether you say it and hear it, see it. Are those hard numbers? Is that something that we should measure? In the old curriculum, we had so many lecture hours, small group teaching, retention percentile is 50, 60%, and overlay that onto the new curriculum, if those are hard numbers. I would only want you to do this if those are hard numbers based on data.
So that quote is not... That is a quote from someone who did a lot of research in that area. Certainly, I cannot tell you right now. I have all the articles from medical education about all the different types of learning, but absolutely something you have heard or read, your retention is about 10 or 20%, and that is in the medical literature.
So, yes. So these are hard. There is evidence for
the lower numbers in the spectrum. The 70 to 95% that I have not seen in medical literature, but that is a quote from somebody who...
So this would be a good exercise, in my view, to map the old curriculum onto the new and what the projected learning percentage would be.
It'd be a very interesting research project for somebody who wants to take it on. Right. So I don't have with me the term that they used for success, but they had searched medical education and change, and these were themes that came up in the articles, which were defined as features that made the curriculum, the new curriculum that they were trying to implement, work or stick. They didn't have in that article a definition of success such as students learned 70% of the material or faculty were satisfied at 85%. They didn't have any measure like that.
Yeah, it seemed to be the way you were referring to it, that it was you were able to change the curriculum. But I think the more important part, even though you had mentioned that the curriculum itself is important change, is the curriculum. Like, whether the new curriculum is better is more important than changing it.
Right. So your point is that if the curriculum was not an important factor of determining whether the new curriculum was able to be implemented, then that's not what we should be looking at. Very important point. Thank you.
So just to repeat Salim's comments for the webcast, so there are measures of success related to the curriculum and learning objectives that we could actually use to see if there's a difference in outcome between the old curriculum and the new curriculum. So thank you to Marion for really making explicit what the challenges are in developing new curriculum, implementing it and integrating it to our areas of practice.